This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Gargi, and today I have with me Stephanie Lemenager and Teresa Shree. Stephanie is Barbara and Carlyle Moore Distinguished Professor in English and American Literature and Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Oregon in the U.S. She's a co-founder with Stephanie Foote of Resilience, a Journal of Environment and Humanities. Teresa is Associate Professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She is the author of Hope at Sea, Possible Ecologies in Oceanic Literature. They have together edited this anthology, Literature and the Environment, Critical and Primary Resources, published with Bloomsbury Academic last year. As always, I'd like to start with the beginnings. What's the genesis of this anthology? How did you come to work on this project? Anyone of you could take this question.
Well, I'll say a few words, if that's okay. And then maybe Tess also has a few words to say. Hi, everybody. I'm Stephanie. And nice to meet you, Gargi. I'm happy to be part of your discussion here today. So this was a project that was presented to Professor Shree and myself by Bloomsbury Academic in a very broad way. They said, you know, we'd like to have this collection, this four-volume collection on literature and environment. Would you be interested? And I know for myself, I was interested in part because I felt like this field has been part of a cultural movement in a kind of surprising way, even though, you know, we can look at it in a very academic context, beginning with eco-criticism and its evolution in the 1990s. Really, there are many ways in which the field imaginary of literature and environment, which is very broad, has been part of a movement to reimagine humanism, maybe to even push humanism to the side and enter a new era of thought called post-humanism. It's also been part of a movement to provincialize European and Anglo-American modes of thought, to use a phrase from Dipesh Chakrabarty's famous book, Provincializing Europe. And it's opened the door to, I think, a new and profound centralization of indigenous thinking and criticism and writing within what used to be known as environmental studies. So I feel like there's been a kind of catalytic aspect to the study of literature and environment that is valuable. But in a way, part of the catalytic aspect of it is that it is displacing itself, that it's kind of pushing, it itself may be kind of ending as a field imaginary as these other voices and modes of criticism and authority come to the fore. So in some ways, this is a retrospective on a field that may not have a very long genealogy going forward, but that I think has changed the way that the humanities are understood within certainly the European and American Academy. So those are my motivations. And I know I was really excited to work with Professor Shuri because of all the work that she has done in post-colonial and decolonial studies.
I can jump in here too. First of all, I'm Tess Shuri, and Gargi, thank you so much for having us on the podcast. I love the way that Stephanie just described kind of this field and how it has been changing and sort of becoming dispersed and sort of distributed. I guess one reason that I really wanted to get involved in this is that I love collaborative research, and I think that's something that has not been as common in literary studies in the humanities, but in this field, literature and the environment, as well as the environmental humanities, that is quite prevalent and encouraged. And so that was one thing that interested me. And then just following up on what Stephanie was saying, this is such a kind of diverse, deep, ever-changing sort of field. And I was really drawn to thinking about it in maybe a larger sense than I usually do in my own sort of specific area of it. So we were able to bring so many different kind of currents of research in this field together, areas like post-colonial eco-criticism and environmental justice and new materialisms. And so it was really exciting to be able to think in a broader way than I often do as a scholar.
You have brought together 100 essential critical articles across four volumes, and the publisher's website claims that this is a comprehensive collection of the most important academic writings in this field. I know now, as Stephanie said, that this was proposed by the publisher itself, but did you have, what was your justification when you thought, why is there a need for this anthology? What justification did you give yourself?
Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, I don't think Tess or I would say it is a comprehensive treatment of the field. And we, you know, first of all, we're aware that we're within the US academic system, even though Tess is from New Zealand and has a different perspective on, you know, kind of a, I think, a really healthy critical perspective coming from outside of that system, that national system. But, you know, we're aware that there's some real regional and you know, international kinds of limitations on this collection that we weren't able to entirely transcend. So I just want to make that kind of critical comment about comprehensiveness first. But then I'll say that I think, as I said in my answer to your first question, Gargi, I think that there's a way in which, regardless of the limitations, regardless of the sort of privileging in certain ways of voices that are allied to global power, which we couldn't entirely get away from, I do feel like there's been a fairly profound critique of traditional forms of humanism with their racist and colonialist biases, a fairly profound reevaluation of the limitations of capitalism and the ways that has structured university systems throughout the world, but certainly in the US and in Britain and Europe and Australia. All countries that are well represented in our collection. So I think that when we look at a collection like this, we're looking at a kind of reevaluation of what it means to be human, a reevaluation of what the aspirations might be for a mode of social being and a mode of education that takes us into a transition period away from fossil fuel capitalism. I don't want to make claims that are too grandiose for this collection or for the work that any of us do, but I think that work that happens in the academy does interact with larger social movements. And I feel like a lot of the works represented here are part of social movements that are profoundly critical of colonialism, that are critical of humanism, that's traditionally understood, that try to usher in a world that is more attuned to both ecological justice and social justice. And And I find that very exciting. And so it seemed to me worth it to become part of this project. Yet I'm also aware of the limitations, the fact that it's not comprehensive, also the fact that it comes at a very high price point, which both Professor Shiri and I regret.
Yeah, I would just follow up on that. As Stephen and I, from the very beginning, kind of talked about how, like, it would be impossible to sort of bring together the field in any absolute or kind of perfect way. And so I think what we sort of ended up doing was drawing on a range of scholarship that is very diverse, but that we organized into kind of areas so that we could highlight some of the affiliations and exchanges that are going on in specific areas of the field. So, you know, we have kind of sections on debates about the term nature in the field. We have a section on, you know, decolonizing the field, which is at least in some parts of the world kind of developed, and to emphasize sort of very particular narrow set of literatures. So we definitely were being kind of selective with the field rather than trying to sort of create a coverage of everything. But in terms of the question of why I see this project as important or justified, I think to me, there's so much exciting work going on in literature and the environment and the environmental humanities around sort of how imagination and stories and the arts, you know, interact with environmental crises. You know, both are shaped by them and shape them. And also, as Stephanie was saying, around some of the ethical and social issues that are woven into these crises too. So I really hope that the collection can suggest kind of the value of humanistic approaches to the environment.
Before we come to the organization of this book, I want to ask if you had any particular audience in mind when you were writing this, or was this also specified, or was this specified with the publisher itself?
I know one of the ways that I got through graduate school was reading collections such as this. So I imagined, and I don't know if this is proven to be true or is going to prove to be true or not, but I imagined myself, I went to a fairly conservative institution for my graduate degree, where some of the field, some of the work in the fields I was interested in wasn't really being done at my institution. And so it was important for me to find collections and sort of reviews of the field and of professional possibilities that I couldn't find at my home institution. And that was the audience I imagined. I imagined graduate students, but I think maybe the publishers had other ideas, and I'm curious to see what Tess says. So
I would definitely say something similar. When I was in grad school, I don't think there was any other student or professor who was working in literature and the environment at my university. And so and there weren't that many kind of pieces that really kind of draw together some of the major currents and areas in the field. So I would definitely hope that this could be of interest to people maybe starting out in the field, possibly people teaching as well, and sort of wanting to see how a introduction to this field might be structured, and to also kind of get a sense of some of the range of the field. So that could be another audience.
Yeah, if I can add one more thing to that, I agree with teaching or people who kind of decide that they have an interest in the cultural studies of environment that they didn't realize they had. And we're hoping that the collection is broad enough and diverse enough that everybody can find a point of entry into it and then build their own genealogy or their own field imaginary. You know, that was kind of the desire, I think, that we had, not to be comprehensive per se, but to give people a strong overview that is diverse enough that you can then take this collection and begin to build your own critical infrastructure from it.
I would also like to talk a little bit about now the organization. As you have said, there are four volumes to this anthology. The first is the field genealogies, networks, and trajectories. The second is why literature. And the third is about interdisciplinary conversations. And the last one is called field contexts. Were these titles also decided before you had the call for papers, or was this something that came out as a result of the conversations that you had? Because I read that there was also a call for papers for suggestions. Am I wrong?
Yeah, there was a call for papers. I feel like I should let Tess speak first this time. Do you want to go ahead, Tess?
Sure. Yeah, we did a sort of crowd. We approached it in some ways through a kind of crowdsourcing method. Like, we wrote to a lot of colleagues, as many as we could think of, and got suggestions. You know, what would they want to see in this kind of collection? And we did get a lot of amazing suggestions. And then from memory, we sort of, as we were reading through and finding these pieces and sort of adding to them ourselves, we just started thinking, how on earth would we organize this? And some kind of broad structure started emerging. The collection starts off more, I think, in the realm of literature and the environment, and more in literary studies and the sort of histories there. And then it moves to the kind of more interdisciplinary aspects of the field into the environmental humanities. But that was sort of the process, I would say.
I would agree. It's kind of almost a dialectical process where we have the crowdsourcing, which was really, really helpful. And we try to acknowledge everyone, or at least most of the people who participated in that, in our acknowledgments. And then we had a kind of series of conversations about how do we organize this? And we really wanted to emphasize the relationship between the kind of cultural disciplines, sometimes known as the humanities, and the sciences, which are crucial and foundational to the development of this field. But we also wanted to talk explicitly about what the affordances of literature are. What does literature make possible that maybe other expressive forms don't do quite as well? And why is literary study in some ways at the center of a movement to shift values in the humanities away from the human and towards relationships, toward interrelationship in particular? Is there a way in which this field is naturally dissolving into a kind of series of interdisciplinary collaborations was a question we had. And maybe that actually says something about the strength of the field rather than its weakness. It seems to me that most things that are worth paying attention to don't hold space forever. And, you know, that may be true of literature and environment as well.
In the introduction, the very introduction of this book, you have also distinguished between eco-criticism, ecological cultural studies, and environmental humanities. Can you elaborate on the distinction between these three for the listeners? Teresa, maybe you would like
to... I can start it. Yeah. So eco-criticism refers to a kind of more disciplinary approach, so to the study of literature in connection with environmental issues. It was a term that kind of got institutionalized in the 1990s through the establishment of some programs, academic programs and journals. And so I think of eco-criticism as a somewhat narrower concept. And then environmental humanities is this fairly vast field of exchanges across different humanistic disciplines, also with the humanistic social sciences.
And ecological and cultural studies.
Yeah, thank you, Gargi. Yeah, I would add that ecological cultural studies is serving in our volume as a catch-all term for work in the study of ecology and culture that doesn't quite fit the the rubric of eco-criticism, but maybe also isn't actively participating in what we think of as the environmental humanities. And ecological cultural studies often incorporate some version of Marxist or post-Marxist thought. So I think about the work of Raymond Williams in particular as a kind of originary point for ecological cultural studies, but I think you could also see ecological cultural studies in the work of post-colonial critics like Elizabeth Alagri or Rob Nixon. There are any kind of work that seems to have a particular Marxist inflection and a kind of pays attention to questions of justice that incorporate critiques of capitalism and class would definitely be within what I would call ecological cultural studies. So I think we're both using the term as a kind of broad term to catch what doesn't quite fit within ecological, or sorry, eco-criticism or environmental humanities, but we're also using the term to specify people whose critical and ideological orientations might be more aligned with cultural studies as it was understood in the British tradition after Raymond Williams and Stuart Hall.
Not far from this is also the distinction between ecological and environmental, given that, as you have already pointed out, there are many complex and diverse ways in which these fields are coming together and interacting with each other. Is this an important distinction to make? And if so, why would you say that?
I think, you know, we're kind of stuck with the term environment, and I don't want to be the kind of English professor that spends my career taking apart terms that carry cultural burdens that I don't care to associate myself with. But I will say that the term environment, you know, as many critics have made note of, is a term that suggests that somehow that which is not human, and including the many relationships that the human species has with non-human being, is somehow an externality, is somehow located outside of the very foundation of what we are as human animals. And that is a kind of dualistic inheritance from the, you know, Judeo-Christian traditions of Europe. And we're not necessarily trying to perpetuate that. And yet the term environment has this tremendous purchase. It's been associated with various social movements. It has a power in the world. And so it sort of stands in the place of maybe more precise and better understandings of what we mean when we try to talk about non-human lives and more than human systems. Now, ecology, of course, for us coming out of a sort of Anglo-American university system relates very much to the science of ecology, which came about in the 1950s as a critique of the military-industrial complex, to go back to the historian Donald Worster's understanding of the history of ecology as a science. It goes back farther than that, but its popularization has a lot to do with critiquing the military-industrial complex, the kind of mentality that could justify dropping an atomic bomb, all of that, you know, a kind of nihilistic version of power that we can see in the Cold War. So I think ecology has its own political resonance, but it also has this foundation in science, which makes it much more attuned, I think, to a kind of sensitivity to more than human systems and the importance of valuing those profound interrelationships amongst all lives that make it possible to continue living on this planet. So ecology has a sort of, to my mind at least, more explicitly scientific, but also post-humanist resonance to it. When I talk about ecological justice, I'm following David Schlossberg's work, in which he talks about ecological justice specifically is about justice for the more than human world, whereas environmental justice is about essentially social justice within an environmentalist framework that makes sure to distribute the burdens of industrialization and development equally amongst all humans, and also to simply try to alleviate human suffering as a result of that kind of development. I don't know if that makes it clear. I feel like I've talked maybe too long, but there's a good deal to think about in regard to what terms like ecology and environment hold, and the ways that they are very specific to the wealthiest nations and their sort of history of wielding power.
Teresa, would you like to add something?
I think Stephanie summed that up really beautifully. Thank you. I would just reinforce, I think that they do have specific histories and nuances, and yet they often are used interchangeably. And there's a lot of terms in the field that can be somewhat troubling or create a certain friction. There are others like nature and the non-human and the human. And I think we spend some of our time, you know, being attentive to those issues and to the histories behind the terms. And then, as Stephanie also said, it can be important to allow oneself to kind of focus on other things as well in the field. And this discussion was making me think of my one of the classes that I teach on fantasy and ecology, and students sometimes do complain to me that there's not enough science in the course, because I do think that term ecology kind of raises that expectation. And so I do sometimes think, oh, maybe I should change the title to fantasy and the environment, so I can sort of then focus on how our fantasy engages with, you know, the relations between people and other creatures and ecosystems, but without having to kind of put a lot of focus on the science of ecology. So that is just an example of some of the kind of expectations that the different terms can raise.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Introduction to the first volume of this anthology, you're saying, and I'm putting it in quotes here, this volume challenges the familiar history of eco-critical practices as a singular process narrative that unfolds in waves. Could you unpack this for us a little?
Sure. Well, we're referring there to Professor Scott Slovic's important theory of the development of eco-criticism as a field, primarily within the U.S., although I think he uses an Anglo-American framework. First of all, this isn't a collection that's explicitly rooted in the story of eco-criticism, even though we really want to respect that story and respect all the work that the founders of eco-criticism did to make our own thought possible, you know, including Professor Slovic. What we see, though, when we kind of look at the history of critical work on literature and the environment, broadly speaking, is a lot of sophistication at all stages and a lot of kind of potentially radical thinking at all stages of critical engagement. In other words, the people who were writing very early in this field in 1970s even, had some really interesting ideas that are being reiterated in various ways now. And certainly Cheryl Glatfelty, who introduced eco-criticism within the American Academy and in some ways worldwide in her volume with Harold Fromm. Her essays in that book invite a kind of thinking that is in many ways pushing towards indigenous thought and philosophy, pushing away from kind of colonial structures of epistemological understanding, trying to think differently about how we know what we know. She even to some degree invites some of the insights of new materialism by talking about the porosity of human humanity and its sort of interrelation with others in this world. So, I mean, we could say if we were interested in a generational model that somehow, you know, this is the beginning and then all this other work becomes more sophisticated and builds on it. But on the other hand, you can say that there's in the beginning a lot of the same insights that we see reiterated in different ways in very contemporary eco-critical work. And then if you expand on the field and say, well, it's not just eco-criticism we're interested in, but this other idea of environmental cultural studies or ecological cultural studies based more in a Marxist tradition, environmental media studies, if we want to look to at all of the philosophical and activist contexts that have been brought to bear on literature and environment as a multidisciplinary field, you know, you begin to see that there isn't one unifying story that can be imagined in terms of one generation surpassing the next. This is a field that has been to some degree radically open to elements from outside since its inception.
Oh, I would agree with that. I think we really, from the very beginning, we were super clear that we wanted to avoid framing this in terms of a wave model of scholarship where you could kind of imply that earlier texts are sort of outdated in some way. And so we, even within our sections, we kind of, each section, we tried to draw on texts that were written and published in different times. And, you know, that is kind of quite a sort of big area in literature and the environment and the environmental humanities is thinking about sort of past cultures and how they might be estranging, you know, how they are complex on their own terms, or even sometimes how they can be strangely familiar to us. So we sort of wanted to, in the way we structured the book and organized the material, we wanted to kind of echo that really complex sense of time and its relationship with environmental thinking. So
Of all the people in the field of literature and environment or ecology slash and or ecology I have interviewed for this podcast, I've always asked this question, why literature and environment? And you have a very innovative way of asking this question in the second volume, and which is, and I'm quoting here again, why literature has been this the seedbed for so much environmental criticism and thought. So my question is, why indeed? And because I hadn't reflected on the importance of this question for the academic literature. And if you could also talk about why has this question occupied such a prominent space?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a really fascinating question and not one that I feel that we have a definitive answer to, because literature in a way is so moldable and it does so many things. One of the things that we talk about literature as being interesting for is it's often it's very imaginative, and it is often diverging from a very kind of strict realism or from an effort to kind of offer a kind of faithful, sort of fairly direct representation of something. And also we mentioned fantasy and surrealism and some of the discussions about those literary modes in the field, and the way that sometimes the world that we're living in can feel so jarring or unpredictable or strange, that these literary, very imaginative kind of engagements with the world and literature, while they're not sort of directly mapping those shifts and changes, they are kind of resonating with people in terms of some of their experiences of what it is like to be, you know, living with climate change, or, you know, things like really intensive fires or oceanic change. So that sort of fictionality or use of imagination in literature is one opening onto that question, but there are many more.
Yeah, and I would say two things for me. One, you know, no present tense is inevitable or total, and I do feel like literature kind of reminds us of that in just in its mode of being. You know, it offers alternate versions of the real to remind us of how provincial any given reality might be, and to also open the possibility for radical change, for difference, and for social transition. So that's one way that I get sort of find excitement and possibility in the literary and in the arts more broadly, not just literature. And then I would also say, for me at least, in literature, we see something that some of our feminist science studies and new materialist scholars also emphasize for us, which is that relationship precedes relata, that it's not so much that the world is made up these sort of isolado individual agents who find a way to come together, but rather that any given consciousness is a kind of network of relating entities. It's sort of a powerful representation of that in a recent book would be Jenny Offal's The Weather, you know, which is a fine novel of climate crisis, but also a novel of consciousness in which the weather is very much the stuff of the mind. You can find, you know, similar examples in other literature, certainly, but I think that is, there's something very profound about the way the literature can express the deep interrelationship and entanglement of the so-called human in the world with the world.
In the third and the fourth volume of this anthology, you have put together lots of context for scholars of literature and environment or students, undergraduate and graduate, who would be interested in this question. I want to know about how was this selection process done? And I'm asking this because when you are specifying particular works, did it make you apprehensive that this would also become standardized? Because I mean, you have said that you're looking at it as a means to reach the future. Did you feel that the future may become standardized through these anthologies, this particular anthology, if I might ask? Was this a question that came up, or it wasn't really?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, I would say, you know, that this book is only intending to reach the future in the sense that the past is entangled with the future. You know, it's not, we're not predicting or mandating anything, but we're trying to give a reasonable account of a series of pasts and of a kind of intertwined set of histories of ideas. We had all kinds of limitations on what we were going to present. I mean, as Tess and I prepared for this interview with you, Gargi, we were actually looking back on our tables of contents and seeing all of the things we were trying to include and all of the cuts that had to be made, sometimes because we simply couldn't get permission for articles or because the permissions were so expensive that we could not include things that we wanted to include. So there were decisions that were made for us that we didn't approve of, you know, but we had to accept. Absolutely, there are ways in which this this set of collaborative possibilities that Volume 3 and 4 lay out is limited. But at the same time, I still can say, having looked at the most recent table of contents, in addition to all of those that we had to abandon, that I think it's fairly generative. And that is all that we hoped we could be, which is to say, not comprehensive, not mandating a certain program of study, but rather generative. What have been some interesting and exciting conversations that have taken place between scholars, activists, authors, that could be built on by others? How can we lay them out in the best possible way, even, you know, in the face of some obvious limitations? There's, like I said, a very specific global regional bias that we couldn't really entirely get beyond in this collection. We did try to push beyond it, but we understand that we didn't entirely succeed in that. There are ways in which the field of literature and environment eludes capture, and that's actually kind of a good thing. And I think we try to make note of that as much as we can. So hopefully our humility in the face of the hugeness of this field, as well as our kind of continual positing of the fact that this is a series of conversations that we hope is generative and not, and we recognize is not complete, prevents a sort of colonization of future study.
We definitely tried to emphasize the limits of the project in the introductions in several places. That was something that I was almost surprised by, the kind of limits that came up. I felt them so strongly while we were working on this. And as Stephanie said, it was everything from literally getting denied permission for some things to just feeling my lack of knowledge and awareness in certain areas of the field. So those limits just felt very pressing at times while we were working on this. Something that we were talking about just before this meeting was how dense this collection is in a way. Like, I'm not sure if anyone will read it from beginning to end, but it would be a lot of work, and it would create all kinds of openings into different kind of areas of the field that are not directly represented or engaged here. So I do think that every essay in the collection is a kind of entry into more areas of the field. So I would hope that people might find their way from this to things that we didn't include too.
What do you hope the readers takes from this book, or what do you hope changes in academia after this book is published?
You go ahead.
I hope that someone reading it would feel kind of inspired by the range of different possibilities for what it can mean to be involved in this field. It does cover, you know, a lot of different kinds of areas and debates and discussions that are going on in the field. I hope that they would come away with a sense of the depth and the complexity of, research that's being done here. And, one of my favorite sections is the primary text section where we've included excerpts from literary works. And so I hope someone would really enjoy reading through those very kind of inspiring and interesting pieces, and and maybe think about more ways to study them too.
Yeah, and I would agree with all of that. I would also say I hope that it's a volume that helps readers to get a kind of at least first view of how a certain history of ideas has developed over time in relation to the way that literature and to some extent other media has engaged the more than human world and has been shaped by the more than human world. I think for me, creating the volume also reminded me that being human is not only something to regret, because I see so much in it of brilliance, of engagement, of an aspiration towards justice, and also of just a profound sort of eros or sort of joyous desire to be enamored with and entangled with the world of radical others. And, you know, there's so much right now to feel regret about, certainly coming from a US perspective. There's so much to feel afraid of right now in the world. And there's a great deal in this thought that to me is a resource for not just changing the way that we study culture in the academy, but also a resource for reminding everyone that cultural expression is profoundly valuable and possibly contributes to our biological survival, our ecological survival.
Because we are now at the end of the podcast, I'd like to take a little bit liberty here and ask you about your future projects. What are you working on right now? What can we hope to read from you in the future?
I'm currently working on two projects. So my main project is a book project that's about humor and environmental cultures in the Pacific, mostly focused on humorous arts in relation to climate change and looking at a number of different kinds of modes of humor, from satire to absurdism to surrealism. And then on the side, I'm doing some essays about the night, cultures of the night, and the night sky. And so, yeah, those are the two main things that I'm working on right now.
Yeah. And I'm working on a book about fiction and lies in the era of what I'm calling climate transition. And it is somewhat of an argument for the power of literary imagination, especially in the face of the proliferation of propaganda, lies, and conspiracy theories that we've seen in recent years and that have been profoundly affecting the political landscape of the US and other nations. And then I have another book that I'm working on with a colleague, Marshall Weisinger, who's an historian, where we have we've conducted 53 histories of the public lands in the state of Oregon, where I now live. And we're writing about the value of the public lands as seen by a variety of different stakeholders, which ultimately this book becomes a kind of disquisition on what the term public has come to mean and public ownership.
Thank you for sharing. They sound like wonderful projects, and I wish you the very best. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Gargi, and best of luck with your projects as well. And thank you for having us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.